Thank you, Howie. So I thought I would start with a picture of the place you wish you were instead of sitting here listening to my talk. This is also symbolic of our desire to believe that there are extra degrees of freedom available to us, whether they really are or not. It's a good introduction to extra dimensions. Another good introduction to extra dimensions is a quote from my favorite philosopher of science, specifically to the current situation of the extra dimensions, 1,000 flies can't be wrong. I didn't do a serious numerical study here, but this is at least a lower bound on the number of papers on spires on extra dimensions in the last 5 years. And I also didn't try to count how many models there are. In fact, as I'll advocate in a few minutes, you shouldn't call most of these things models. You should call them scenarios. But certainly there's a lot of activity here. On the other hand, we just had two very nice descriptions of the what remains the dominant paradigm for beyond the standard model physics, which is supersymmetry at the weak scale, and in fact, some version of the Susie Desert. And that's probably telling you many things. It's telling you something about Susie, but it's also telling you something about how we actually think about this extra dimensions activity that we're spending a lot of our time on. And what I want to advocate today is that although lots of wonderful things have been happening with extra dimensions, maybe we do need to reorient our thinking a bit. I'm sure you have already, I'm going to assume, in fact, for this talk, that all of you have, whether you liked it or not, have heard at least 10 talks on extra dimensions, so that I don't have to explain to you that lots of interesting things have been done by postulating extra dimensions of various types at various scales. Many, many interesting things in many different mutually exclusive models. Used to explain electric symmetry breaking, breaking Susie, explain flavor properties of standard model, give new explanations of the hierarchy problem. And all that is great, but this is extra dimensions considered as a model building tool. And I just want to remind you of something which is an obvious fact, which is that that's the tail wagging the dog. If there really are extra dimensions and we can actually discover them, that's a huge thing. Forget about electric weak symmetry breaking. I would much rather discover extra dimensions, right? And I couldn't even think of a good enough hyperbole to put in here. I mean, that would be great. If I can do that, then I'm done. So what I want to advocate is that in addition to writing thousands of papers, we should actually get serious about extra dimensions and kind of evaluate what we really think and then act on that in some serious way. So unlike most talks that I give, I'm going to attempt in this talk to tell you what I really think about extra dimensions. Yeah, it's a problem. I'll get my hands in the tapes later. And what I really think is that we should be serious about extra dimensions. I don't know what kind of extra dimensions, but we should be serious about the idea that there are extra dimensions and that they are physical, that they interact with stuff that we can go out and measure in such a way that we should be able to discover them either directly or indirectly if they're there. But in order to do that, we're going to have a serious experimental plan to discover extra dimensions, not just to do the things we're doing anyway and then hope that there's some extra dimensional thing thrown in for free. And in particular, we don't know what kind of extra dimensions there are, and we don't know what scales they're going to show up at. And they may not show up at accessible energy scales. They may only show up at super heavy scales, in which case it's even more challenging to detect their effects and know that you're seeing supersymmetry. So this is not easy. On the other hand, as I said in the previous slide, discovering extra dimensions is a really big deal. So we shouldn't be afraid to say that one of the major long-term goals of high energy physics is to determine whether or not there are extra dimensions that have observable physical consequences. And we should go out and do that. Now, all of this is predicated on the idea that you have some sort of level of belief that there are some kind of extra dimensions out there. So I wanted to tell you what my own belief is. And I invented this scale, which I think is sufficiently explicit that you can figure it out for yourself. And so now I want to say, what is the confidence level that there are some kind of extra dimensions that have observable physical consequences? So I'm not telling you which model I'm talking about, just some kind of extra dimensions that we can observe directly or indirectly. And I think on this scale, the answer is 8. At least I have about the same confidence that there are some kind of extra dimensions with some kind of observable consequences, at about the same confidence level that I believe in supersymmetry. So that's not my highest level of belief, but it's pretty high. And I want to explain to you why that is.
Where is your string level?
It's actually it's related to this. So let me just get to that. Yeah, it's related to this. I think there's in my mind, there's two strong arguments for the existence of some kind of extra dimensions with observable physical consequences. One is the standard model, and the other has to do with string theory, and actually these two arguments are related. The standard model argument is based on this statement, which I hope everybody agrees with, that the standard model favor structure is too complicated for a theory of supposedly elementary constituents. Now, if you don't believe that, then you're not going to come along with me for the rest of this. If you believe that, then this is telling us something. It's telling us that there's something going on. There's degrees of freedom that we don't know about. Now, in the old days, this happened several times, and the answer was that the things that you thought were the elementary constituents were not elementary constituents. They were composites of something. That may still be true for the quarks and leptons of the standard model, but we have now probed, for example, the electron at length scales less than 100,000 times its Compton wavelength, and it doesn't have any structure yet. Now, I could make a theory where it's still a composite, but I would say that with the exception of the top quark, that compositeness for the quarks and leptons of the standard model is a bad bet for the answer to this problem. That's not the only approach to this, and of course, many people have made many models where you add extra symmetries, extra degrees of freedom, flavor symmetries, and to try and make a real model like that, you probably end up gauging those symmetries, trying to combine it with the gauge symmetries, and then you have to break all that extra stuff that you put in to get back to the messy structure of the standard model. And as all of you know, that's very hard to do. To have a complete theory of flavor that way is very hard. And you end up, by the end of the day, when you really try and get a complete theory, you end up doing a lot of ad hoc and nasty things. And I think that's true in any approach to this that anybody has taken. So it doesn't mean that part of the answer to all of this structure in the standard model isn't things like this, but it's hard for me to believe that that's the entire answer. And then I run out of explanations. The only other sort of generic explanation that I have for this complicated structure is the other kind of extra degrees of freedom that I know about, which is compactified extra dimensions. And I don't know necessarily where they come from, but it's hard for me to believe that you're ever really going to understand the structure of the standard model without introducing a few extra dimensions to give you the extra degrees of freedom you need to get this structure. Now, the way people usually talk about extra dimensions is they say, well, there's this theory called string theory, and string theory is very weird, and it has many weird properties, and one of the weird properties is that it predicts there's 10 dimensions of space. So, first of all, I would like to assert that although that is a prediction of string theory, it's not a weird prediction. In fact, I had to write a popular article about string theory. And if you just sort of sit down and think about it, you're trying to make quantize a relativistic theory of an extended object. It's not surprising that that either fails, or in order to get a sensible theory where the lowest modes behave like massless particles, you have to do a discrete tuning of the number of dimensions, because what else are you going to do? Michael. Yes, that's a good point. So it's not weird that string theory tells you what the dimension of space-time is. And it could have been 4, but it's a good thing it wasn't 4, because if it was 4, string theory would be wrong. And it's wrong for this just the reason I was talking about. String theory is supposed to be a unified theory of a single kind of featureless constituent. And furthermore, it's got gravity built into it, so its fundamental scale is the Planck scale. That means all the standard model stuff has to come from zero modes. So if you just had a four-dimensional string, where are you going to get all the complicated structure of the Standard Model from? You're not. So it's a good thing string theory wants to live in 10 dimensions, because if it wanted to live in 4 dimensions, we would have thrown it away already. You're shaking your head, but only mildly, so I take that as encouragement. All right, having said all that, of course, we don't know, even if there are extra dimensions, we don't know what is the scale at which they start to show up. And of course, all these arguments about flavor structure, part of the problem with that argument is we don't know what are the scales where the flavor structure of the Standard Model comes from. So saying that it's connected somehow to the Standard Model doesn't tell you what the scales are. On the other hand, one of the interesting developments of the last 20 years is that all of the scales of new physics that people think about seem to cluster together, roughly speaking. There is this big high energy scale that seems to have to do with unification, string theory, gravity, even seesaw neutrino masses, and it's all way up here somewhere. Then there's our friend the TEV scale, which we've already started to see it, and we don't know exactly what it goes up to, but it's some range like that. And then there's a scale that we didn't order, but we seem to have anyway, and I don't know what that means. Maybe it doesn't mean anything fundamentally. Maybe it's related to these other scales. So it's not stupid to think that if there are extra dimensions and that if they're observable at all, that they show up at one of these scales. Now, if you ask me what I really think, I think that probably the most likely place for them is this scale. But I don't know. Maybe some of them, maybe one of them at least. I only need one. If one of them shows up the TEV scale, I'm happy. Now, before I get into the real substance of this talk, I just want to give you a list of a way of thinking about extra dimensions models that isn't the usual way where you just sort of list a bunch of models that give names according to who invented them. And I think this sort of helps you think more generically about what we mean when we talk about an experimental program for extra dimensions. And this is a point where I also want to say that you should think about the things people are doing as scenarios. In fact, Savas Demopoulos, I think, invented this terminology. That's what we're really doing in extra dimensions. We're making a set of physical assumptions, and I'll tell you what those kinds of assumptions are. And these lead you in certain directions which you think, with a lot more work, would lead to a respectable class of models of some type. But I think we're still more in this phase than we are in this phase. And so there's a lot of work to be done there. So when I say it's a scenario is defined by physical assumptions, what are the things you have to tell me? You have to tell me how many extra dimensions at each energy scale. You have to tell me what you did with them, how you compactified them. And it's not just a question of the geometry of the compactification. But once I've got extra dimensions, I can turn on fields in those extra directions. I can have fluxes of gauge fields. I could have non-trivial profiles for scalar fields. I can have non-trivial things happening in those extra dimensions. And this kind of stuff is very important for understanding what kind of symmetries are broken or not broken when you do these compactifications. So I have to tell you all that. It's important to know whether there's curvature in the bulk. It's important to know whether, once I've compactified, generically when I compactify, there's going to be some kind of moduli type fields like radions. And once I stabilize these configurations and make a real model, some of these things may actually be visible as heavy particles with not too weak couplings. So I need to know that. I need to know what gravity is doing, because it may be doing something interesting with observable consequences, or it may be doing something that's already ruled out. If I have brains in the model, I need to know who lives on the brains and who lives in the bulk. And it's not just a question of who has Kaluza-Klein modes, which follows from this, but it's also a question of what kinds of things can get volume-suppressed couplings. It's a way of generating small couplings. And last but not least, if you want to have a model, you have to worry about things which are likely to kill models. One is that these are theories of gravity, so they are inherently unstable. And that's something we don't worry about enough, probably. and there are consistency problems. For example, brains have stuff on them. If they have stuff on them, they will tend to generate certain terms, like kinetic terms for things, including gravity, even if you didn't put them in at tree level. So you have to worry about the consistency when you include radiative corrections in these models. And the brain radiative corrections are generically different from bulk corrections. So you have to worry about if you're really looking at a consistent setup. And as is true in supergravity models, you have to have at least some clue or some assumption, which may or may not be reasonable, about what the ultraviolet completion is of these non-renormalizable theories. Because even Planck-suppressed effects, if they're the wrong kind, can have important consequences. So that gets me to the real substance of the talk, which is what I think is a list of experimental issues. And I won't actually be able to get past the first list thing on the list here. But this was not meant to be a list of things which have already been done. It's meant to be a list of things that need to be done. And the one I'll actually talk about is this issue, which is not going to go away, which is I see a signal which could be an extra dimension. Now prove to me that it's an extra dimension and not something else. That's a very interesting challenge. A lot of these scenarios, you have to wonder how exactly you get experimental handles on them. Some of these scenarios have very direct consequences. Some of them are more indirect, and some of them are really indirect. And again, you have to worry about what's the kind of chain of inference, if you like, to claim that you've seen extra dimensions. Very practical things. Once you have a model, then you want to somehow systematize these models into some kind of benchmarks and have event generators for them. Again, people are thinking about things like this for very simple models, but we want to have more serious models. And in fact, as is true also of supersymmetry or any theory of physics beyond the standard model, it turns out that astrophysics exists, and so we actually have to think about it these days. And in addition to thinking about LHC and linear collider physics, there's a lot of happening in flavor physics, very constraining, and also opportunities for signals. So let me get to this first issue. How do you know it's extra dimensions and not something else? In most of the scenarios I know about, there isn't an experimentally accessible smoking gun that says, I'm an extra dimension and nothing else. And so in almost every case, in fact, every case that I know of, it's going to be a difficult multi-channel analysis, lots of things to worry about, to confirm what may in fact have been an initial discovery of extra dimensions. And let me start with the easiest case. The easiest case I know of is the original, what's called Randall Syndrome 1 model. This is where you have the Planck brain, the TEV brain. It's a small extra dimension, but it has TEV scale consequences. And in fact, the consequences are very dramatic. You get these Kluze-Klein graviton resonances that I can see in lepton pairs. And so boom, 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 here's my Kluze-Klein graviton modes. The spacing in the masses is related to the zeros of Bessel functions. And boy, if you see that, you know, you're happy. But still, if I'm going to get up and say I've discovered Kluze-Klein gravitons, I better make sure that they have two properties that gravitons have. One is they better be spin 2, and the other one is that they should couple like gravity, because they're gravitons. So fortunately, in this case, you do, because you're seeing these nice resonances, you have the ability to do some kind of analysis about the spin by looking at angular distributions. And this is probably a better plot of what you really do. What you want to do is look in different channels that these things can decay into, compare them. You'd better see them all, because this is supposed to be a graviton. It's supposed to couple like gravity. And then in each case, you want to show that the thing you're seeing is the spin 2 object by looking at angular distributions. And of course, it's more complicated because there's different ways they are produced. So even in the simplest case, it's a big job. And this is by far the simplest case I know. Here's a more typical case, and this is Ian talked about, where you're really lucky. You have TEV direct consequences of extra dimensions. But the way you see them is as smooth excesses over standard model backgrounds. So here's a typical kind of thing where I'm, again, producing Kluze-Klein gravitons, but they have, as far as I can tell, an almost continuous mass distribution. And as a result, the thing I actually see is a missing energy distribution or a monojet ET distribution. where the signal coming from extra dimensions is this red stuff. And of course, as in all these cases, my ability to even say that there's something to worry about here is completely dependent on the accuracy with which I can compute these standard model backgrounds and the accuracy with which I can understand how this stuff looks in my detector. So it's a challenge just to say that there's an excess, and then so what if there's an excess? How do you show that that's extra dimensional? So the answer to the question of how I get confidence about the backgrounds is I measure them in the detector where I'm seeing this effect.
No, I'm measuring the electronic channels for which you said, I mean, you asked if that was this, because then you might also be
saying too. Yeah, I think. So that's an example that you've probably seen before. Here's one you may not have seen. It's in a similar but different class of models. It makes a different set of assumptions. These are sort of like ADD models, but in these models, there are inverse TEV size extra dimensions. And because of that, you can actually assume that the standard model gauge bosons live in the bulk instead of everything being on the brain. So in addition to Klutz-Klein gravitons, I have Klutz-Klein gluons, for example. And because of the ability to exchange these, I get a enhancement in the diject cross-section in IBT. And that looks like this. And again, this is the colors is for different assumptions about the, so 1 over this is the size of the extra dimension. So this is the red is the smallest extra dimension. It's 1 over 15 TeV in size. And again, you're seeing some smooth excess in IBT diject stuff now. And you want to know whether that's extra dimensions. And this is an interesting case because you actually have very good sensitivity. I mean, 15 TeV at the LHC is good sensitivity. But you'd like to have some idea of whether this is extra dimensions or something else, because there are many things that could do this. The obvious thing to do, which doesn't work, is to say, well, don't look at the cross-section, you idiot. Look at the diject in various mats, and you should see peaks, because I have Klutz-Klein gluon resonances. This is what the peaks look like. They're very small. And furthermore, this is a standard model background. So the S-channel production doesn't save you, and you do have to do this harder problem. Now let me move on to another set of models which make totally different assumptions from what I was just talking about, but again give you different but interesting challenges. And these are the universal extra dimensions models. And the simplest version of them, so universal means that everybody moves in these extra dimensions, and I'm just going to have one of them, and I'm going to compactify it in almost the simplest way possible, just on an interval, the simplest orbifold. Everybody lives in the bulk. And you try and do an honest calculation of what a model looks like this looks like in terms of the K spectrum. You do the radiative corrections, and you also try to be consistent about including brain kinetic terms. And then you get a spectrum for a standard model KK modes. And it looks like this, and this looks very familiar. It looks almost exactly like, well, it looks exactly like something you could have gotten from supersymmetry. So that's a very interesting challenge. And now I have to distinguish that from supersymmetry. Well, there are many ways you can do that. Let me mention several interesting ways. One obvious thing to do is the spectrum I just showed you is for the first massive KK modes of all the standard model particles. Of course, if I can see kinematically, if I can see the second or third KK mode levels, then I start to think this must be extra dimensions and not supersymmetry. There's also some more interesting and exotic ways of distinguishing these things. One of them, as pointed out by these people, is that some of these Kaluza-Klein modes, in particular the KK modes of the right-handed quarks, have suppressed decays. Because of that, they hang around for a while, and they hang around long enough to form KK quarkonia, to form bound states with fairly narrow peaks, as you see here. And so that would be, if you could actually measure this, that would be a very interesting way of detecting universal extra dimensions. And another one, which is very interesting, is to look for these effects in heavy flavor physics, in B physics and can physics, as pointed out in a series of papers by these people. And this is a very interesting set of things to think about. Universal extra dimensions are actually not very constrained due to the fact that they don't have tree level effects and that they give flavor violation, but they belong to this class of models that give minimal flavor violation. And because of that, universal extra dimensions could actually be have a radius, a 1 over radius, as small as 300 GeV. That's good because actually it's in this range from sort of 300 GeV to 1 TeV where you could actually see the effects of these universal extra dimensions in heavy flavor experiments. And again, there's many things that can give you anomalies in these sorts of experiments, but you get a certain pattern from universal extra dimensions. And again, that pattern may not be unique, but it's interesting that there's a pattern. And certain things are enhanced over the standard model values, and certain things are suppressed. And by reasonably large amounts, as long as you're in this range that's below about 1 TeV. And so, again, if you start to see signals, everybody's happy. I mean, this is Copio. This is B factory. This is Hadron Collider B physics. There's something for everybody to see. And also, this makes the point that, again, once again, your ability to see what could be an incredibly important discovery is limited by how well you understand the standard model. And this was actually, until I read these papers, I had no idea what any of this stuff was. But in this particular class of decays, there's this kinematic parameter. So this is a dimensionless quantity. It's defined as the value of these kinematic variables where the forward-backward asymmetry in this process vanishes. So it's some number, and you can compute it from first principles. And it's been computed now from next to leading order. That gives you this 0.162, the dotted line up here. If you hadn't computed the next to leading order corrections, you would have thought it was 0.142. And so, in fact, it's only your ability to know this very accurately that would allow you, in principle, to measure this and say that there is a suppression due possibly to the existence of extra dimensions. So it's nice the way all these things tie in. Okay, so now I have been talking about several different kinds of extra dimension scenarios where there is direct extra dimensional stuff at the TeV scale. Now, as I said, the thing that I actually believe is that it's more likely to find extra dimensions associated with higher scales, and furthermore, which I guess I haven't said yet, with supersymmetry, because I think the motivations for the dominant Susie paradigm are correct. They are not inconsistent with the existence of extra dimensions. So what I really believe is that both of these things are there. I think supersymmetry is there. I think there probably is something like the Susie desert, and I think there's probably extra dimensions, and probably they show up at the top of the desert rather than the bottom. So, okay, that's fine. That still means they can have interesting measurable physical effects, and we have to figure out what the possibilities are for those effects. So one possibility, which I think was first suggested by Witten, is that perhaps the first extra dimension opens up at an energy scale that's, say, an order of magnitude below where the gauge coupling unification scale is for the MSSM. And this then has interesting effects. It doesn't cause you to start over with the usual paradigm, but it has interesting measurable effects. And furthermore, it's something that you can calculate with if you're assuming that the ultraviolet cutoff scale, where I don't know what I'm doing anymore, where I have to do string theory, is a couple order magnitudes above this scale. So it's something we can talk about intelligently. And again, the simplest thing you can imagine is that I have one extra dimension of this type showing up at this scale, and I can assume the simplest thing, that it's a simple orbifold like an interval or something a little more complicated than that. This turns out to give you very interesting and productive improvements over the standard SUSY SU5 picture, immediately, with making very few assumptions. One thing you can do is that you can break SU5 just from extra-dimensional effects without introducing an adjoint Higgs with SC5. Second, you can solve the double-triplet splitting problem in a very simple way, basically because the colored Higgs triplet that usually is the thing giving you trouble, its zero mode gets projected out by the orbifolding, the simple orbifolding that I did. And you can even do things like explain why in SU5, B tau unification seems to be a pretty good prediction, whereas the rest of them are crappy. And it has to do with the fact that the generations are doing different things in this one extra dimensional orbifold. And various people have pursued this idea. In fact, you might go so far to say that all of the things that made us think that supersymmetric SU5 was a good idea, although it seemed to have a few residual problems, is evidence for the existence of this extra dimension, which looks like it might fix up those residual problems. But of course, that's not good enough. What you really need to do is make additional predictions that you can go out and measure at the TEV scale. And one of the nice things about these models is if you're really doing a simple orbifolding like this, there's very few parameters that are going into this. You're breaking symmetries in very simple ways. And so the models tend to be predictive. So here's an example from Hall and Nomura where they actually predict the whole SUSY spectrum based on just a couple of parameters. And they even predict observable rates for lepton number violation. So these models are predictive if they're these simple versions. Here's something else you can do, which is a little more non-standard, but it's still consistent with the dominant paradigm that there's some kind of SUSY and there's some kind of grand unification like SU5. But in this case, we're going to take a warped extra dimension. It's similar in sort of the picture to Randall-Sundrum in that it's a single warped dimension. There's a Planck brain and a TEV brain. But unlike in Randall-Sundrum, we're going to live on the Planck brain. So quarks and leptons are living over here. And the stuff I'm going to put over in the TEV brain now is going to be the stuff that normally I am weakly coupled to because those couplings have gut scale suppressions. And those things are actually that colored Higgs triplet, which tends to give you two rapid proton decay, and the super heavy X and Y bosons of the SU5 model. So in other words, in this sort of model, you're using this Randall-Sundrum warping in order to allow these particles, which normally are the super heavy particles of SU5, to have TEV masses. And the reason why that's okay is because their couplings to us are suppressed by TEV masses instead of gut masses, but there's an additional wave function suppression from the warping that makes things okay. So again, it's a very simple idea, and now it makes a very dramatic prediction. It says that, gee, you know, actually these SU5 particles that you thought were super heavy are TEV scale, and you can look for them at the LHC. And these people have done an analysis about how you would do that for this colored Higgs particle. This is an interesting particle because whichever one of these guys, this colored triplet Higgs or its super partner, is the lightest one, that one's going to be stable and it's going to hadronize. And what it's going to look like is a heavy stable charged particle. And in the detector, it's going to be sort of like a heavy muon. So it's one of these interesting, funny things that you can go out and look for if you know that you want to go out and look for something like that. So that's about it. I want to just recapitulate a couple things, because again, I'm not trying to just show you all the things that have been done, but sort of try and outline the things that I think ought to be done. So here's a couple of predictions. It's true that in some sense, and this is sort of practical utility, there's already too many of these models floating around. It's hard to even keep track of all of them. And it's hard to summarize them in a talk like this. And in fact, they're getting worse because the model builders are rediscovering the things that the string theorists invented when they were doing this from the top down. So they started out doing, you know, the simplest things like a torus compactification, and then they figured out how to do simple orbifolds, and then they figured out how to do fancier and fancier things. I was amazed to read in a paper just recently that somebody had realized that in trying to break gauge symmetries with extra dimensions, they couldn't reduce the rank of the group. So they said, oh, well, I should instead of doing this simple orbifolding, I should do a non-abelian orbifolding. So they're rediscovering all the things that the string theorists used in order to get models that do interesting things. So that's bad. That means that we're going to have inevitably a huge proliferation of models, even worse than what we have now. But because these models are doing all kinds of different, very different kinds of things with respect to electric symmetry breaking and supersymmetry, once you have experimental guidance, of course, 99.9% of that phase space is going to go away. So things to do, I want to leave you with two things. So this is the repeat of one of my slides. I think from the theoretical point of view, in terms of having things that you can actually call a model, these things that I listed before are the things that need the most work. And I want to say something more about this question of ultraviolet completion. We had a similar problem, as I mentioned, 20 years ago with supergravity models. Supergravity models, it's not the only way to do SUSY, but when you do SUSY that way, you actually do have to say something about the presence or absence of Planck-suppressed operators, because they affect what you see in the spectrum at low energies. And so people had various sets of assumptions that then got names, if they were sufficiently popular, like minimal supergravity, no-scale supergravity, things like that. This is a case where string theory, at least, maybe not for everybody, but for me, actually did some good. One of the things you can ask is, by making various naive assumptions about what string theory does, what do you tend to get in terms of these different sets of assumptions? And I think the current status is that it seems sort of natural to get no-scale supergravity, and I don't know any cases where it seems natural for some reason in string theory to get minimal supergravity. Not a proof, but this is our source of ultraviolet completions, and any hint that it gives us, we should take seriously. But better than that, one of the things that came from string theory was that it suggested a new class of Planck-suppressed operators that people hadn't thought about. These are operators that have powers of M Planck in the denominator and have in the numerator the F-term VEVs of various moduli fields like the string dilaton. And that's very interesting because those things, if they're there, change the spectrum that's observable at the LHC and the linear collider. Turning it around, when you measure these things at the LHC and the linear collider, you are detecting the presence or absence of this stuff. And I think that's very exciting. So you can do this for supergravity. You can do it, presumably, for extra dimensions with a little more thought. So I'm going to close with this list again. As I said, I really only talked about the first thing on this list. I think in terms of experimental issues, there's lots and lots of things to do here, and there's lots of very serious work because, first of all, lots of different ways that extra dimensions can show up, and secondly, because they tend to show up in ways that are experimentally challenging. And so anybody that I think is interested in sort of this long-term project, there's already, such a long list of things to do that everybody should pitch in and do something, whatever is appropriate to their talents. And I think that's it. Thank you.
No smoking gun in most models that you know. But of course, in any models where the Planck size is small as compared to the size of the extra dimensions, the generic prediction is that you're going to hit the fundamental Planck scale long before you thought you would have. And the generic prediction there is that you start making black holes. And I think that's not really a smoking gun, but more a smoking cannon.
I completely agree. And the only reason I didn't bring that up was, I guess, again, it's trying to say what my own prejudice is. And my own prejudice is that we're not going to see that at accessible energy scales. But I don't know. And you're absolutely right. If we're lucky, that is a smoking gun, I think.
In these gambling targets, you thought that one. The reason that you're looking at the color triplets and the XMI bosons down in the East is there's no overlap in that wave function between them and the standard model.
Yeah, it's essentially, it's exponentially spread.
So then how do I predict what they have there on the LHC when it's 70 by 70 more pilots are calling? But maybe Houston is an opening. And so why don't I get some kind of roof protector for using the roof on the weekend? Some high-end, many of the high-end preservation?
It is my understanding that the current state of the art of these models is that although this basic setup I told you improves the situation for proton decay a lot, that when they looked at it in more detail, it's not good enough. And that they end up invoking additional suppression.
Okay, so actually, great problem.
Yeah, so this is the difference between a scenario and a model.
Joe, I think you've shown us several examples where you can see only the beginnings of the signal and the signal fluctuation of the LHC. I'm wondering then, in that case, wouldn't you really want to build a VLHC to get the above the production rate rather than building a video combiner which would probably not be able to do the LHC?
Yeah, I think especially in a scenario where you think you've seen an actual Kaluza-Klein mode, the way to be really sure is to make 10 of them, right? So you build a collider that has 10 times the energy. And, I think if we play our cards right, we could even get the money to do that. And that's maybe the only scenario I can think of where you would get the money to do the VLHC.
Okay, let's thank all the morning speakers.